Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Marshall Poe, the editor-in-chief of the network, and each week we scour the internet looking for interesting new books. And this week, I'm very pleased to say we have Robert Gelatley on the show. He's been a guest on the show before, and this time we're talking about his terrific new book, Stalin's Curse, Battling for Communism in War and Cold War. This is a revisionist book in the full sense, as you'll see during the course of the interview. Robert has some very interesting things to say about Stalin and Stalin's role in, what shall we say, well, let's just say it in a kind of full-throated way, starting the Cold War. So I look forward to hearing him talk a little bit about that. But before we turn to the book itself, Robert, maybe you could begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Well, and I teach at Florida State University, where I'm the Earl Rayback Professor of History. I teach mostly now comparative history courses dealing with the USSR and Nazi Germany, the Holocaust. I teach on the course on the Holocaust. I was born and raised in Newfoundland. I went to the London School of Economics in London to do my PhD. I've taught at a variety of places, and now I'm here, and you know, they're treating me like a king, well, like a prince, and you know, everything is just great here. I really enjoy the university atmosphere that we have. It's very welcoming and southern, and, you know, it's very relaxed. This summer, unfortunately, we've had a lot of rain. That's my only complaint. Yeah. A little bit too much rain.
Yeah. Is there a place more different than Newfoundland than Florida?
I can't think of the contrast being tougher. Yeah. I mean, I occasionally tell people, you know, I'm now an American citizen, but I tell people where I was born. I show them a picture of St. John's, Newfoundland, right, in the middle of the summer, when the wind changes and westerly winds, it changes to easterlies occasionally and blows the icebergs into the into the harbor at St. John's Harbor, and you can stand on the on St. John's Harbor and look out towards Britain. The first place is, you know, is Ireland, and it's solid ice, yeah, as far as the eye can see, and this is in June and July.
Right. No icebergs in Florida, so you don't have to worry about that.
No icebergs in Florida.
Yeah,
I guarantee
great.
You that.
Yeah.
No.
So
I haven't. Yeah.
So I was going to say, let me ask this. Why did you write this book? You've written a lot of books. You wrote a book on Stalin and Hitler, and most of your work is on German history, per se. Your early works were sort of fundamental to the Nazi period. And now this is a book that's basically about Russian history, or I guess I'd call it international history, but it's about Stalin. So why did you write this book?
Oh, that's, you know, well, I tell you, what happened is that my natural curiosity kept leading me on and on. I started with an interest in doing a comparative study of Stalin and Hitler. That was, now it seems like about 10 years ago, 15 years ago. And I realized that really would not work very well, because I don't think it's possible to understand Stalin without understanding Lenin. And so that became a very large book called Lenin, Stalin, and Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
When I was finished that, there was so much material that I wanted to talk about, so many more things I wanted to say about Stalin, who emerged in my mind as an incredibly interesting character. That I decided, well, you know, I would just look at the you know, how he got involved, and what happened to Stalin in the period after 1945, and so I didn't really know exactly how the book would turn out. I had no preconceptions. I had I had a general familiarity with American diplomatic history, but nothing. You know, I wasn't wedded to some particular school of thought or other. And so I thought, oh, I'll just, you know, so I just looked at this character and the people around him. And, of course, there was a huge flood of documentation that became available. And I decided I would look at to get my own view. I'm not an anti-Stalin or a pro-Stalin. I'm not anti-communist or pro-communist. I'm sort of a middle-of-the-road kind of person. I wanted to get a, in quotes, objective view of it. So I went back to the sources. I had studied Russian as an undergraduate, and I went into this, and as one of my friends said, when he finally saw the new book, Stalin's Curse, he said, I didn't think you were going to go whole hog into this. And so what happened is I got involved in it, and it became bigger and bigger, and I ended up with enough material, actually. I found so much that was so fascinating that I had enough material at least for two volumes or even three volumes without going past Stalin's death in 1953. Mm-hmm. So there's so much more to say about this guy. And the system that he created, and his mental world, and the kinds of things he did, he's one of the most fascinating characters in the 20th century, and I suppose one could argue he is the most influential political figure of the 20th century. Certainly, I think a strong case could be made. I can't think of anybody more influential. So everything he touched, he was, a master of understatement. One of these people who, the more you learn about him, the more brilliant he becomes. People think that he's an evil genius or whatever it is. They say all kinds of things about him. About his mental problems and this, that, and the other thing. I think you really have to take this man seriously. How does someone whose second language, is Russian, second language, someone who's born in the Caucasus in Georgia, which is not exactly a popular brand in Russia, as most people will know, coming from the Caucasus in Georgia, and now he becomes the head of and the most powerful man, the most powerful ruler in all of Russian history. It's an extraordinary accomplishment. And how he does all this, and at the same time, how he has this image, this theoretical understanding of the world. I disagree with what he wants to do, very, very much. But I didn't start off by dismissing what he was up to out of hand as somehow ridiculous, or that he was some historians have said he was just a psychopath who liked to kill people. Well, I think he may have liked to kill people, but he had quite clear political strategies. Sometimes these got out of hand, but he was very much the hands-on ruler, workaholic, a man with a mission, and so on. And when you see how he operates and the way he deals in international situations and so forth, it's amazing. He's an extremely one of the most exciting people in history that I've come across.
Mm-hmm. And certainly one of the most controversial. There have been, I know this because I've dabbled in Soviet history a little bit, there are a number of different, I guess I might call them paradigms or ways of looking at Stalin that try to explain some of what he did in terms of internal and external policy. One, which was popular where I taught for a while, let's put it that way, was that there was kind of general continuity between Stalin and sort of 19th century modernizing czars, that he was more Russian than the Russians, and he was interested in pursuing Russian interests primarily, and that he was not necessarily driven by a kind of Marxist-Leninist or Marxist-Leninist-Stalinist ideology. He was really interested in making Russia a great power or the greatest power. And that explains. I don't think you agree with that.
No. You see, on the one hand, I think that to to some extent, he does become a Russian nationalist or a believer in, you know, Russia. And I'm not trying to say that Russian history started in 1917. There are no doubt strong lines of continuity in Russian history from the imperial into the Soviet period. It's overwhelming. The lines of continuity, especially if you look outside the big cities in the rural areas and so forth. So there are very strong lines of continuity, and that I would not dispute. But what I think I do dispute, I think there was a fundamental break in the ruling strategies of the government between the Tsarist regime and initially the Leninist and then overwhelmingly the Stalinist regime. And I think Stalin accepted the Leninist, Marxist-Leninist interpretation of world history and the revolutionary ideology that grew from that. And he developed, he and Lenin and others, Trotsky and many more, developed a mission for the Soviet Union. And this mission in the world, I know this sounds like something out of the 1950s, that, oh, there's this rent under the bed kind of thing, but they developed a mission in the world to bring revolution, the communist revolution, to the world. And it was going to start in the Soviet Union, and from there, of course, as you know, it was thought it couldn't survive in the Soviet Union without revolution elsewhere. And the fact that revolution was stopped in 1918 and 1919 in Western Europe, the Soviets carried on anyway. And the remarkable thing is that Stalin was one of the few people who realized that when the next war came in 1939, he realized very early on that this was an opportunity. Unlike many people in the world, he saw this as an opportunity to take up again the revolutionary cause that had been sort of put on hold since the end of the Civil War in the early 1920s. So he saw this as the revolution, that war, the Second World War, would have a revolutionary impact on European society and Soviet society, so just as the First World War had. Mm-hmm. And the task that had been not completed by the First World War would be surely completed by the Second. Mm-hmm. And he said, Hitler, without knowing it, is playing a revolutionary role. And he said all this in 1939 before anything really got rolling. An astounding insight that that historians, by the way, social historians, found out about or started looking at that war that way only in the 1980s and 1990s. Mm-hmm. We already figured it out way in advance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think to understand what you just said, we have to, again, turn back to the historiography. And I'm thinking particularly of the American or Western historiography and attempts to come to grips with Stalin. And the thing that I'm reminded of is what's called the Great Retreat. The thesis concerning the Great Retreat, and this is a phrase that was used even in the 1930s, and it was the moment at which Stalin said that there could be socialism in one country. Because prior to that, and again, I think this is something that people forget, Lenin and his compatriots, including Stalin, never believed that there could be socialism in one country. They thought that if socialism came, it would come as a world revolution, at least among the advanced powers in Europe. That was the only way it could happen. And saying anything different would get you thrown out of the party. But all of a sudden, Stalin, and then I can't remember the exact date, but it was in the early 30s, I think, says, no, in fact, we can do this alone. So in a sense, what you're saying is he was saying that, and he did say that. He said we can have socialism in one country, but always in the back of his mind was this notion that it really couldn't just happen in the Soviet Union. It had to happen everywhere. Does that make sense of what you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely does. You see, what happened is what is sometimes forgotten is how Stalin built everything around the Leninist, many of the Leninist principles. And in 1923, when Lenin introduced an economic policy, This is already regarded by many hardline communists in the Soviet Union as something of a retreat. And he said, we have to take one step back. We have to take one step back. That is to say, we have to introduce some, or reintroduce or allow some aspects of capitalism or a marketplace for a time until we can take a great leap forward. You see, this great leap forward. Of course, that became an expression used by Mao Zedong for his what turned out to be a disastrous industrialization project later on. But for Stalin, the great leap forward, you see, was preparing to make this great leap forward, and the opportunity was going to come. He didn't say this until he kept trying to avoid the war because he didn't think the Soviet Union was ready for the war, but when it came, he thought this would be an opportunity to take up again the Leninist cause of the mission, the sacred mission, to establish the Red Empire, that I call the Red Empire, which is an empire of communist states that would be independent communist states and that would somehow be linked to Moscow in some way. And so this was a great retreat, no doubt. But to prepare to take the great leap forward, then Stalin, of course, that's his, he thought this would be the great contribution that mm-hmm. Lenin would often realize the Leninist mission.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So
even as the war, you see, he carries on the struggle through the war, even when he's completely, beaten down, so to speak, in 1941, after June. Even though he's completely beaten down, he never lets up. And even though in 1944, the Soviet Union is up to its eyeballs in the Second World War, losing millions of people, including millions to starvation and everything else, he is still, nevertheless, meeting with the heads of communist parties, of all European communist parties, who will be going back to their countries to bring about something like a very modest Soviet style government. But these will be cleverly disguised. He was a real realpolitiker, mm-hmm. someone who believed in realistic politics. And so, we're not going to have just someone go in there and who's a communist and say, now I'm the head of the government. So they would go in there behind so-called national front governments, and they would establish these regimes, and then would slowly and surely they would take over. But this would be a gradual process.
Mm-hmm.
So even though he is devoting all this energy and time to winning the war, he is the head of the Soviet armed forces. He is responsible in excruciating detail in planning the war. He carries the struggle right on to the war. At the same time as he's doing this, he's making no less, his strategy is no less important on the political front. And so he's always fighting this political front. And when he meets the allies, the Allied leaders at the two wartime conferences in Tehran and Yalta, they are trying to win the war. That's their main and almost their entire concern. And he is trying to win the war. But at the same time, he is already focused on trying to win the peace. And so that he has a clearly worked out strategy about what's going to happen and they don't, and they keep. So they keep in a way. They keep trying to appease him, and he plays in that role. He's always someone who's an expert at playing roles. In his role as the great statesman at these conferences, he's playing the aggrieved nationalist politician whose people have suffered greatly, and indeed they have suffered greatly, and who needs just this one. One little country here and one little country there to guarantee their national security, so they won't be attacked again. And no one can dispute that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, in fact, also true. But just as true and perhaps even more important. He wants to be sure that these countries are politically friendly towards him, towards the Soviet Union.
I'm glad you mentioned the war, because I think this bears on another question that you touch on in the book, and I think is very relevant for understanding Stalin. Most Americans, let's just speak of Americans for a moment, think of the war as, and thought of the war as, a kind of campaign against evil. The Nazis were evil. The Japanese, it's a little bit different case, but let's just talk about the war in Europe. The Nazis were evil. They were not democratic. They were not Republican in the sense we mean Republican. They oppressed national minorities, and they were imperialists. And these are things that Americans will have nothing to do with. At least that's what Americans told themselves. Of course, parts of it's false. So we went to help our European allies on those grounds. We were about defeating this evil imperialist power. I'd say the same is true of the English and the French. How did Stalin see the battle against Hitler? What frame did he put it in? How did he understand it? What did he call it? I mean, how did he explain it?
Oh, well, it's very Stalin's understanding of Hitler. Of course, first of all, I'll say he, in general, he would have agreed with very much with these war aims, the ones you've you've enunciated. He was against all the very same things that the other ally were for. In that sense, he was they were on the same wavelength. Where he differed is in his interpretation of Nazism. They saw Nazism as the product of a demented and a demonic Hitler, it was not against the German people fighting supposedly, but against this demonic Hitler and Nazism. He saw Nazism in a completely different light, and he also made some diabolically incorrect or horribly incorrect interpretations of Nazism. He thought that Nazism was basically that the Nazi Party and Hitler were in the pay of the capitalists, and the capitalists were after but they were always after the imperialists, out to conquer goods and territory and those sorts of things. And this was the last stage of capitalism was entering its final stage, another final stage, so to speak. Supposedly reached it already in 1914, but never mind that. So he interpreted the Soviet. Is my phone doing this or is it yours?
I'm sorry. No, that was mine. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, so he interpreted Hitler wrongly, because what he didn't understand about Hitler is that he was something of a populist leader who had the backing of the people. Of course, this is the title of another controversial book I wrote called Backing Hitler, Consent and Coercion in Nazi Germany. But that Hitler had the backing of the German people, that there was a real social movement. And that, of course, although there were opponents in Germany to Hitler, the vast majority of the people were backed him. And this was a genuine German phenomenon, not just a Nazi or a Hitler phenomenon. So he didn't understand that Hitler had far, far, far broader ideological goals. So what Stalin did between August 1939 and June 41, in August 1939, as you'll know, Stalin arranged to have a treaty with Hitler, and it was this treaty, the Nazi-Soviet Pact, or sometimes the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, that helped to unleash the first wave of the war against Poland. Interestingly enough, this was overlooked at the Nuremberg trials later on.
Yeah.
But that's another story. Yeah. That's not a popular one to bring up in Russia these days, I don't think.
No.
But in any case, so what he did between August 1939 and June 1941 was that the Soviet Union gave Nazi Germany practically everything they asked for. And this is the one that I found in my research, is the extraordinary lengths to which the Soviet Union and Stalin in particular, and specifically Stalin, went to provide Hitler and Germany with everything, every natural resource they needed, all the food they could use, all the food they wanted, all the oil and everything else that they wanted. And it was precisely because, I mean, there was so much, the goods were so enormous that were moving from east to west on the railways that the railways were getting clogged. The German negotiators, however, realized that this was not a Soviet problem, but a German problem, because they just couldn't get enough railway cars to cart all the stuff away. And they gave them these goods at very favorable prices. So much so that the German negotiators at the time said, the entire East is ours. We can have everything we want, as much as we want. And this indicated that, as far as I am concerned, Stalin was prepared to do everything possible to satisfy his new ally, Hitler, short of war. And he thought that in this way, by giving Hitler everything he wanted, that this would ensure peace would reign, at least for the time being. He never dreamt that war would be over permanently, but that this would be an important step forward.
Mm-hmm. So he saw, as I understand what you said, Nazism as another one of these final stages of capitalism or perversions of capitalism, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. So how did he – let me ask this.
Okay.
How did he see his allies during the war? How did he see America and France and Britain? What sort of conceptual box did he put them in?
Okay. Now, as far as he's concerned, these are all capitalist countries. They are doomed to extinction. This doesn't mean that he doesn't want to take advantage of them and so forth. The reason that he is so convinced that the world is going his way is that he has the Marxist-Leninist theory about the progress of history through various stages, and that capitalism is doomed to extinction to be succeeded by communism. He's completely wedded to this idea, but this doesn't mean that he's not willing to take advantage of these allies to defeat Nazi Germany when indeed it comes to the war.
Mm-hmm. And so did he really think of – so let me put the question a little bit differently. So is it too much to say that he conceived that there would be a confrontation between the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany, and that would be followed by some sort of confrontation between the Soviet Union and the other capitalist powers?
Yes, there would be an inevitable clash,
mm-hmm.
and this would come, however, sometime, preferably way down the road. There was going to become this clash. What he was absolutely convinced,
mm-hmm.
and anything. This doesn't mean he was, a false ally or something. I'm not trying to say that, but that he always had a political agenda. He, no matter what else he said, this is what leaders from the West didn't understand when they met him, is that he had a very specific political agenda, and no matter what he would do to mask this, the agenda was not going to go away. So. People, when they met him, they felt he made them feel very comfortable. He didn't want anyone to talk about communism. If you look through all the meetings they had with the Allies, the word communism or revolution or anything like this never occurs. He makes all his wishes known in terms of what is needed for the security of the Soviet Union. He never says, we want this because of our political philosophy or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And even when he bumps into his allies, you know, people who come to Moscow, like the Yugoslavs who come to Moscow, he says to them, why have you got those red stars on your hat? You don't need those red stars. Get those off your hat.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to just alarm the Allies. Get them off there. And
did he trust Churchill and Roosevelt and later Truman?
Oh, I don't think so. No, I mean, you know, not say trust and verify, trust but verify. He didn't trust them at all. I mean, he's playing a double game with them the whole way through. The unfortunate part about it is that he misses so many opportunities, a number of major opportunities to benefit his people, as opposed to fulfilling his political mission, the political mission as he sees it. I don't know. Have we mentioned what happened at Potsdam?
No, I think we should talk about both Potsdam. Well, we should talk about Yalta and then Potsdam. Because
okay.
You know, some people will say about Yalta that, you know, the standard line is, at least from one point of view, is that Churchill and, well, especially Roosevelt was very naive, and Stalin took advantage of this naivete. Do you have an interpretation of that, or can you speak to that?
Yeah, I think that the point is essentially true. I think there are historians, I mean, with books that have come out in the last year or two, where they say that Roosevelt won at Yalta. Well, I'm afraid that's just not true. They all but conceded all of Stalin's political, immediate political, European political aims at that time. And, you know, they got really nothing in return for it, except something that Stalin had already promised to do, which was to go to war against Japan. And that was the only sort of concession. The United States and Britain did not have a whole lot of bargaining chips at Yalta. The Soviet Union had carried the bulk of the war. It had a many million strong Red Army in the field. The United States and Britain hadn't even made it into Germany, and the Soviet Union was perched and ready for an all-out assault on the German borders, and they were really unequal partners at that time. Stalin played it very, very cool, though. He never made his obvious political demands. He never really laid them out at all. And I think Roosevelt was in the last months of his life. He was not very healthy. And, you know, people were worried about him and disturbed at his appearances. And I'm afraid he wasn't in the strongest position. And Churchill was determined at all costs to appease Stalin. He even in the case of Poland, it was a bit of a disheartening read going through all the documents on Yalta, I must say.
So let's move on then to Potsdam. What did you learn about that?
Well, the most interesting thing that I found at Potsdam was present of Harry Truman. He was a breath of fresh air. I mean, sometimes people will say naive. He didn't know this much about foreign policy and so on and so forth. But he was an honest man, a very strange creature in international affairs. And you know, I think he had a generous soul, and he wanted the best for his people. And one of the real turning points in history at Potsdam was when Truman went to Stalin to inform him against Churchill's advice, to inform him about the successful detonation of the first atomic bomb. And when he approached Stalin, he gave him this information. Stalin turned on his heel and said, "Well, I hope you made good use of it, or worse to that effect," and turned and walked away. And I looked really closely at all the documentation surrounding that event, that very small episode, and all the people who were there and their memoirs and their notes at the time and everything I could find, every single note and every piece of evidence. And what's really interesting about it to me is Churchill goes over and says, so what did he say? What did he say? And Truman says, he didn't ask any questions. And the more I looked at this and thought about it and saw how Stalin then reacted and what he did when he went back to his offices and so forth, and in view of the tragic, disastrous situation the Soviet Union was in at that time, I thought, you know, here was a moment where the arms race and Cold War could have been stopped right then and there. All Stalin had to do was to say, Mr. President. I mean, I don't expect him to have come up with this line that day, but they were still meeting in Potsdam for days afterwards. He could have said at some point, Mr. President, I don't know what you've heard and what I said about how many casualties we've suffered in this war, but I have to say that it's 20 million and more. We are in a disastrous condition, but I see this heading, this new weapon here, and now we have a whole new dimension to the war, to war itself, and this is going to lead to an escalating effort. It's going to cost everybody, especially our people, an awful lot of money. I want to stop this now. I want to know all the secrets. Tell me all the secrets. After all, we've carried the war. We've suffered millions and so on. Tell us all the secrets and let's stop this Cold War and arms race before it starts. And, you know, I don't know what Harry Truman would have said in that situation, but being and the honest character he was, I think he would have said, as he said in 1947 about the Marshall Plan, damn it all, yes, I agree, you know, we do have it good in America, and we've got to stop this now, and we've got to devote ourselves to peace and trying to get Europe and your country back on its feet. And it was a great turning point, I thought, where history could have turned and didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a shame.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I, you know, took away from it. Of course, there was lots of many other things in there, but this one was the most monumental. Other things that happened, of course, soon thereafter, like the atomic bomb, and then the Soviet war on Japan, that they go bang bang, you know, 1, 2, 3, with all within a couple of days of each other. That's another chapter, and how the Soviet Union then, even in this incredibly weakened position, Stalin has managed to get more than a million troops out into the Far East, and that's a long ways away mm-hmm. from Moscow, to attack Japan. And indeed, they attack Japan in what is one of the greatest blitzkriegs of all time, and they get to the door, right to the door of Japan,
mm-hmm.
right to the last island before mainland Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. This was then, of course, what he was doing. This was bringing the political mission to Asia, you see.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So can we say anything about Stalin's plans for post-war Europe? Are there any planning documents, or did he meet with the Politburo and say, you know, okay, so here's what we're going to do, and you know, we'll provide aid
here?
Think? Or, you know, I just wonder if there's anything actually on paper.
Oh, yeah. Well, this is where it's the contrast between, let's say, the United States, Britain, and the USSR is the strongest. The Soviet Union begins planning, and he starts specific commissions, plural, to draw up a post-war plans for Europe. The two most important commissions are under Litvinov, the foreign minister, and now deputy foreign commissar, and now deputy foreign commissar, and Ivan Maisky, the former ambassador to Britain. And they have two commissions, and they meet and draw up very lengthy, detailed, highly detailed plans These start, I want to say in 1942 or 43, but I mean, I detail all these documents in the book where they drop these very concise plans. And if you're meeting, if you're an international forum and you're meeting with someone and you have drawn up all the plans and the other person there on the other side has none or virtually none, as was the case with the United States and Great Britain. Now, they do have plans, but there's nothing like this. You are at a tremendous advantage. And so Stalin, when he would go into a meeting, he had all of this down cold. He had all of these documents and all of this, down to a science. And there's, to say there's a paper trail, well, I'm looking at three volumes of documents here sitting right in front of me. So it's a vast documentation.
So can you
follow exactly?
Can you summarize what he wanted to do? I mean, does he say, our goal is to do this?
Well, the goal is to create what I will call the Red Empire. The Red Empire is the continuation of Lenin's dream to bring revolution to the world, and the Red Empire will be the gradual communization or the conversion of the various one country after the next into communism. Now, if this is done too quickly, this is going to get the backs up of the capitalists, the United States and Britain. So this cannot be done overnight. This is going to take time. So we have to just go gradually forward. He met with the Italian, the French, the German, and other communist leaders, and he gave them various kinds of advice on how to proceed, as he did with the Hungarians and others, how to proceed and not go too fast and so forth. This had to be all done very, very in a very measured way. If there were countries that could have gone or might have gone communist, but that would be thought of by the Americans or the British as too threatening, then those revolutionary movements had to be just told to slow down and cool it. And this is what happened, for example, in Greece. So it's not that he didn't want a revolution in Greece. The Greek communists wanted a revolution. There was a revolutionary situation in Greece in 44, 45, but he did not want to aid. He didn't want to aid the Greek communists. He said, look, we do not have a fleet. The British have a fleet. We don't have one. And it's silly. The correlation of powers, you have to think of the correlation of powers.
Yeah,
we attack when we know we can win, and when we don't, we retreat and hold our fire.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So he had it all worked out. And now he was they also had plans, equally worked out plans for Asia. There were less; these were less well-developed because he had the theory that all countries had to go through a certain stages of growth before they could or would be ready for communism. And he thought that China, Vietnam, and other Asian countries were not ripe for communism. When, indeed, communists took power in China, Stalin was delighted. But some of his negotiations with Mao are, I go through those in the book as well. Some of the negotiations are incredible. And of course, and out of that comes the war in Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all extremely well documented now, where we really have the documents to show what the background of the war is. And I go through all this to show how Stalin and the North Koreans were responsible for the war, how they deliberately brought it about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a big question, and I know it's hard to give a summary judgment, but there is an active debate about who started the Cold War. Do you come down on one side or another?
I'm afraid I do.
Mm-hmm.
You see, now, I have to tell you, I'm not a Cold Warrior. First of all, I need to say this. I'm not a Cold Warrior. I'm not an anti-communist or a dyed-in-the-wool communist. I'm interested in historical truth only. That's It sounds boring, but that's the only way I can look my students in the eye and say, this is the only thing I'm interested in here is this. And if you find better facts, or then I'll take back anything I say. And so I have to say that on balance, the overwhelming evidence that the Soviet Union brought about the Cold War. There was an important moment, when the Cold War could have been stopped, even as it was, so to speak, becoming more obvious that such thing existed. And this is in 1947. Now, in 1947, there was a new Secretary of State, George C. Marshall, and he went on with these regular meetings with the foreign ministers in Moscow, and he noticed right away that Stalin was not interested in doing anything to help the European people. By 1947, the situation was so bad in Europe that the British were introducing for the first time in their history bread rationing, and in France there were bread riots, and which is never a very good sign in France. That's when they have revolutions,
yeah,
as it happens. And in the Soviet Union in 1947, there was a genuine famine that cost in excess of a million lives. The Soviet Union was. Even the parts of the country that were not occupied by Germany and hadn't been in the war were all devastated because of the various factors there. So there was a famine there. Now, what Marshall did when he came home from the meeting in Moscow in 1947, he said, "Listen, this has got to stop. We got to do something to help the Europeans to get out of the mess they're in. They don't have enough money. They don't have a plan. They don't know what to do. We need to work out something to help them." And so they drew up a plan, and the plan was a very simple one. Marshall said, "I want to deliver this plan. I want to give the talk at Harvard. It's got to be less than 15 minutes." So when the British and the French heard this, they said, "Well, this is too good to be true." But this is the essence of it. We will aid the Europeans, but the Europeans have to draw up the plan. And if the plan is a good plan, we will do what we can to support it. This money, the plan has to apply. The money has to be offered to the Soviet Union as well, and to all the satellite countries, the countries that are becoming satellites, like Hungary, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Romania, and so on. All of these countries have to be offered the aid as well. And now, revisionist historians have said, "Oh, the Americans in Washington were praying that the Soviets were going to turn it down." But it was Stalin's decision. And Stalin, not only did Stalin turn it down, he went to his foreign minister, Molotov, went to the meetings. All he wanted to know is, how much will the Americans pay? And they stormed out of the meeting. But this was a vital moment in European history. And so the Marshall plan was a plan that then the Europeans drew up without the Soviet Union and without Poland. And even though these countries were desperately poor, all in desperate straits, and wanted to participate in the Marshall Aid Plan and to get this support at a vital time in their history. But no country in Europe needed this aid and this plan more than the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. The Soviet Union was in dire condition. I mean, even the parts of the country of the Soviet Union, and that's part of what I try to do in the book, is to bring in the Soviet context, the Soviet domestic context, to what was going on there, into the discussion about the Cold War, because frequently all we get is a discussion of what goes on between Washington and Moscow and Paris and London, but we don't actually find out much of what's going on inside the Soviet Union. And that's the vital social context. And that makes Stalin's refusal to accept the Marshall Aid Plan all the more difficult to understand. I mean, it's impossible for me here now in a short time to convey how poor they were in the Soviet Union, but even in the parts of the country that were not affected. I mean, I'm reading from a book, by Donald Filzer. It's called The Hazard of Urban Life in Late Stalinist Russia. And this is not an easy read, I will admit. But he shows how desperate the situation was in places that were not even affected by the war.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, it's heartrending. It's heartrending. Mm-hmm. And in 1947, the Soviet Union itself, as I said, had a famine. And, I mean, as bad as it was, and it was terrible and all across Europe, in the Soviet Union, it was arguably worse than anywhere in the entire world.
Mm-hmm.
And that becomes a crucial moment in the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the Truman Plan or the Truman Doctrine. No one took that seriously at all. But what was really important was that Marshall Plan. And now suddenly you have this dramatic contrast. It happens seemingly overnight. Of course, it's not quite an overnight miracle. But what it is, it costs a substantial percentage of the American budget to pay for this. And yet, no one opposed it. The Republicans, and this was there was a Republican House and a Republican Senate, and they passed it. And one of the Republican senators who was leading this to get it through, people said, "Well, this is too much money. We can't give all this much money." He said, "Listen, the worst of this effect, you don't throw a 10-foot line to a man that's dying, that's drowning 15 feet from shore."
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so they got that through, and it was a miracle because all it needed was, there was a lot of infrastructure there in Western Europe. Already, it was ready to go, so to speak. It needed a spark. It needed some way to be able to import enough to get the machinery going, get the livestock going again. And the Soviet in the Soviet Union and the Soviet sphere, they paid for this price. They never got over the Second World War. Mm-hmm. The Soviet sphere and the Soviet Union itself, the gap between the well-being of the people, the wealth, the GDP, however you want to measure it. It starts widening between the United States and the Soviet Union from this point on.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a tragedy, and involved in it as well. Not only is it a tragedy for the people, and it's not a good thing for the United States to have had to spend all that much money on the Cold War. We can imagine the kinds of things we could have done with all the money that we had to spend on these. On these weapons and wars and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a sad tale for everyone, but it's really heartrending, honestly, if you read much about what the people in the Soviet Union were going through.
Mm-hmm.
In the immediate post-war. That's it's just terrible.
Mm-hmm. So we're about out of time. I have a couple of questions. One is very specific and one is general. Let me begin with a specific question. It's something I learned in your book. And let me give a little background. Stalin didn't really leave a political testament. He didn't leave a document that says you should do this, 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 and the other thing. Lenin,
right.
In fact, did leave one. However, you mentioned that in place of a testament, a kind of formal testament, he got very interested in this massive work of economics. Do you remember this in the book? Yes. He convenes all of these experts. You mentioned 250 at some point. And he worked really hard on it. He spent a lot of time on it. He considered himself something of an intellectual and expert. And this was going to be his intellectual legacy. I'd never heard of this book at all. He didn't live to see it published. It was published in 54, right?
Right.
Has anybody ever read this book, or what does it say? Have you looked at it?
What we forget is that in the late 1940s and early 1950s, before he died, Stalin had become all but a god, and he had to be consulted on all intellectual matters, whether it had to do with physics or genetics, especially with genetics and plants and things like that. But he then got it into his head. Actually, he got it into his head already in the 1930s that he wanted to leave an opus, a work that was greater than the one that Marx or Lenin left.
Mm-hmm.
And so he decided and Marx had drawn up the theory, and Lenin got them into power, but Stalin made it all work. So mm-hmm. he was the one, he was the real, you know, the real engineer. So he was going to put these lessons all down. And these had to be, now, these all had to be done, this had to be science. And he wasn't going to have any of this sort of feel-good stuff. It all had to be science. And so he brought in all these intellectuals and support to work on it. And I say in the book, geez, you know, for these people, in quotes, a scientific approach by economists to say why it was that the peasants loved to join the collective farms, and to say objectively how well these were working and so forth, this was going to be a tall order for any economist to show. And so the thing goes through any number of revisions, and no matter what else is going on, in addition to all the other projects he's going on, and there's dozens of them, he is working away on this magnum opus, and there's more drafts and more drafts. At one stage, the entire Central Committee meets and discusses the draft, and he puts, you know, all kinds of other the leading intellectuals, and they then come and talk to him. They then come talk, and they hear these you know, all these incredibly wonderful words from him, and of course this is going to be his dream. His dream book. Well, you know, the final draft, the ultimate final draft was due in March 1953, and of course he died before he saw it. So that was a little bit of a, sad ending to his quest. The book then, it does eventually make it into a form of a textbook, but it never really takes off. It's quietly ignored. Most people probably have never heard of it. It's a sort of modern day. Look at me, ye mighty in despair, and sort of the tale of Ozymandias. But it's a classic case of someone who, and you see, I've tried to avoid all the way through the book. I tried to avoid that this guy is a psychopathic killer or has, you know, of course everybody has their problems, but his mission is what's sacred to him, and mm-hmm. this is the Holy Grail to him, mm-hmm. and he feels that this is his bequest. When he died, the guards did a summary of his worldly belongings and put it down on a single page, and you know it reads like something from a very poor college student's dormitory.
Yeah,
minus just like a two pairs of boots, and you know this certainly nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So he lived for the revolution. I mean, he wore many guises, but he was a revolutionary from the beginning to the end of his life. I think he was a revolutionary from I tried to track when he actually becomes a revolutionary, very briefly anyway, and when he decides at the moment that not only does he want to live for the revolution, but he's willing to kill for it.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to track down when he killed first, or at least when he ordered the first killings, because I thought that was a sort of an important moment. And that comes in the Civil War, back in 1919. But it's at a town, it's a little town, important town, but at the time, and his colleagues thought the event was of some significance, I guess, because later they renamed the town Stalingrad.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Actually,
so
I thought it was.
I find that all very interesting, especially about this book I knew nothing of, because one of the things that occurs to me about Stalin, particularly, is that he tried to uphold the emphasis that I think the Bolsheviks from the late 19th century, early 20th century, especially Lenin, that the leaders would be intellectuals, that they would write things. And, you know, later this becomes kind of a real farce under, especially Brezhnev, because there are even jokes about Brezhnev's books. Of course, he never writes any of them. But Stalin did actually write these things himself. Like, I know that, you know, he writes this very famous tract, I guess it's in 46 or 47, called A Few Questions About Linguistics, which was ubiquitous, just absolutely ubiquitous. And, you know, I have copies of it that I collected in the Soviet Union. I just find that kind of interesting that he thought of himself, really thought of himself in the tradition of Marx and Lenin, in the sense that he was an intellectual. He was somebody who really, you know, his first calling was to be a kind of philosopher. And that's just fascinating to me because it puts him in a different frame, I think. It takes him.
It does.
It makes him much less Machiavellian. You know,
you see, I think some of the interesting documentation that's come out of this out now since the archives have been opened, some of the most interesting is when he's actually interviewing, some would call it interrogating, but he's interviewing the leading intellectuals. For example, he brings in Sergei Eisenstein, the film director, and he's questioning him about Ivan the Terrible, and he liked part one, but he didn't like part two. But what's interesting about it is the nature of the exchange that goes on between them. When he brings in poets and says, he's the guy, after all, who is the one who comes up with the idea of socialist realism, that good art is the kind of art, or good literature is the kind of literature that fosters the revolution, and that's what socialist art should do. This abstract music and abstract painting, not going to happen. We don't want modernist poets. But he knows all the poets, and he's read all the books, and he's gone through all the various leaders and the centuries and the errors and omissions and so forth that they've made. So he's extremely well-informed, a voracious reader, and so on. It's not the image you usually have.
Yeah, no, it really isn't. It really isn't the image you usually have. But he does. I want to say, metal is the word that comes to mind, but it's more than that. I mean, he's truly interested in it. He's not feigning it. He really is interested. I mean, Brezhnev could care less. He wanted to go to Sochi and hang out, and he had books written in his name. But Stalin was a much more, again, I'm going to put serious in quotes, but serious intellectual. He really thought of himself as somebody like that. So let me ask the final and general question. And it's really, I ask you to respond to a statement. I think it was Stephen Kotkin or somebody like that who said that the Soviet Union was killed by a kind of unyielding idealism, that the problem was that the Soviet leaders really failed to understand that the ideas that they began the revolution with were ineffective in doing what they wanted to do. And the great contrast here is China, where the Chinese leaders, at least starting, 15 or 20 years ago, came to the conclusion that the ideas that they had started the revolution with were not working to bring prosperity to the people, because that's what communism promised. And so they switched gears. And the result is modern China, which is, of course, still communist, at least in name, and is run by a single party, but it's very prosperous. And what Kotkin points out, and many people I think have now pointed out, is that the Bolsheviks were just unyielding in this way. They had the truth, and they were going to stick to it no matter what happened. And you've definitely portrayed Stalin in that way. I mean, he's an ideologue in your depiction. But it seems to me it also it continues after he's done. He's not the only one of these people that's sort of trapped by
these.
So he's one of
– I think they totally bought into the Stalinist heritage. And he brought these guys into power. He was, in the terror in the 30s. These are the new men, the Brezhnevs and so on. These were the people who got their break, and he got them in there. And so they were so to speak raised on these ideas. I think it is absolutely true that they were completely unyielding. And they were so committed to this ideology that nothing was going to throw them off the rails. The idea of the revolution, unfortunately, I don't know if Stephen Kotkin mentions this, but the idea of the revolution and their principles become, unfortunately, more important than the people. Mm-hmm. When you start as a leader, when you start putting your ideas or your principles or whatever in front before the well-being of the people, then we have something that we can really call tyranny, mm-hmm. because that's the worst thing that can happen.
Yeah.
You put your ideas before the people, and unfortunately, and what happened is that the people in the Soviet Union, and you know this from studying earlier centuries, you know, the good people, the good Soviet, Russian, Ukrainian people, and so on, they really didn't want to embrace this. The majority didn't really want to embrace this mm-hmm. ideology. And Lenin and co. had no difficulty in saying, well, of course, you know, this is false consciousness. So what you have to do is we need, I'm afraid, terror.
Yeah.
So they introduced the you know, terror from almost from day one, and you know, it was a socialist experiment with truly disastrous consequences.
Yeah.
Now, you know, this Red Empire I said he was going to create, this doesn't necessarily mean, you know, like an enlarged, literally enlarged Soviet Union worldwide, but I think what they never really worked out what this, what the relationship would be between the various states out there and Moscow. Somehow, I think they all thought that these people would be inspired and would naturally want to follow Moscow's example. But they never really worked out what the Red Empire was, how it was going to be held together, the way the British did, for example. They made it clear. But what happened in after the Marshall Plan, you know, was turned down, and the worlds really became divided, is that Stalin said, well, maybe we ought to rethink this Red Empire a little bit, and you know, formalize ever such a little these relationships between the other communist states and ourselves,
mm-hmm.
and of course that then just made the whole situation even worse.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say the thing that really is interesting to me is the degree to which the leaders of the Soviet Union were able to maintain a faith in an idea regardless of the consequences of the imposition of that idea. Just that is fascinating to me. And I think it's partially because I'm an American and we are so pragmatic. At least I think we are. You know, we will abandon an idea in a second if it doesn't serve our interests. You know, and Tocqueville pointed this out. I mean, in many ways, it makes us kind of wishy-washy. If it doesn't work, we're not going to do it. And we're not very principled people in that way.
Yes, the British say, if it's not useful,
it's
not useful, we'll just drop it.
Right, yeah. And this may be an American national characteristic. I don't know. But it seems to me like, you know, if it doesn't work, we're not going to do it. And
it's just
the opposite for these guys, that they had this idea. They were not going to depart from it. They served the idea, regardless that they had incredible faith. And, you know, in a way, in some contexts, that is a real virtue in this context.
Yes.
I think we know from centuries and centuries of political science, it is not a virtue.
No, it's not.
It's not a virtue, yeah.
You know, I mean, what I find, it's difficult for me to comprehend, and it is, you know, did I mention about going to Washington on March the 5th?
No.
I don't think I did. Well, this may be a good way to end. But on March the 5th this year, I went to Washington to talk about the book. The book was published on March the 5th, which I thought was incredibly significant. It was really just a coincidence, but this was the 60th anniversary of Stalin's death. And so I thought, you know, because here I was so excited by the book because I was discovering all this anew. And so much of it is, of course, really new in the sense that it's just coming out of the archives. That I said, you know, this is so exciting and so forth that you know, everyone's going to recognize the significance of this because the story is such a compelling story. It's surely the greatest story of the 20th century. Not necessarily that my book is the greatest book of the 20th century, but that story is.
Yeah.
That story is.
Yeah.
And nobody noticed, actually. I was, you know, I thought, well, where's the media, you know, beating them off? Well,
right.
I didn't have to beat them off.
Right.
the only thing worse than having the media phoning you all the time is not having anybody phone. That turns out that's the worst thing. It's even worse.
I see what you mean. Yeah.
You know, in 1945, in 1944-45, the Soviet Union was the first to liberate the Nazi concentration camps, especially the death camps. And they knew a lot more details. They put in commissions to figure out what had happened, and they knew all the details, and they were going to, you know, this was going to become a book and this, that, and the other thing. And suddenly Stalin put the clamps on and said, no, these aren't Jews. These are ordinary Soviet citizens. And so, strange to say, this became, the Soviet Union became the first Holocaust deniers. I mean, they not that they denied that all these people died. They didn't deny that. But what they denied is that they denied their ethnicity. Mm-hmm. And so these people were posthumously then converted into ordinary Soviet citizens. Mm-hmm. And this is really, you know, a really troubling story, because this is supposed to be a war of good against evil, isn't it?
Yeah.
The Second World War, good, evil, I mean, it's quite clear. Now, what the heck is this? And so I you know, of course, now people, of course, they'll object to everything. But what's astonishing to me about it is, like, why did this happen? And I came to believe that Stalin knew, he instinctively knew that the Holocaust was going to become a bigger story than the Soviet Union and his attempt to, their attempt to carry out this great socialist experiment. And so he played it down.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, going back to my own case here, in a way, I think he was right. The Holocaust has become the Holocaust in the Second World War, at least from the Western point of view, is the biggest story of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a survey of my friends at the scientific survey of my friends at the fitness club where I go, and they all agreed. I said, well, just list the 10 top stories of the 20th century, 10, you know, big stories. And all of them, in the first top three were something like the Holocaust, Second World War, Hitler, or Hitler, Holocaust, Second World War, something, you know, in those in variations. But Stalin and the Cold War, Stalin was way down the list,
mm-hmm.
and the Cold War has been already forgotten.
Yeah.
It's astonishing how fast we've forgotten what happened.
Yeah, that's absolutely. I think you're right. Yeah, you're right. I mean, I don't want to go on and on autobiographically, but I remember, you know, in the 1980s when I was going to college, that it was something people talked about. You know, it was communism was something people talked about, and now nobody talks about it at all. And maybe that's a good thing.
No,
I don't know if it's a good thing or not. So anyway, we've taken up a lot of your time today. We've been talking with Robert Gelatley about his book, Stalin's Curse, Battling for Communism in War and Cold War. Robert, we have a traditional final question on New Books, on the New Books Network, and that is, what are you working on now? What's your current project?
Well, what's happened is I've never entirely been able to get over my interest in Nazi Germany and the Third Reich. So I've returned to that, and I'm reading all the new documentation and the books that have come out on that recently. And so the next book is going to be on something on Hitler and the Third Reich.
Mm-hmm.
But exactly what? I've got one project already underway, but the bigger sort of writing project, I haven't fully decided exactly what. But let's say I'm getting itchy fingers again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you never really know what you think until you write it down. At least that's my experience. I always go, like, I'm going to write this, and then I start to write, and then I write something else.
that's
true.
Well, that's why I had no intention of writing a book on Stalin, but the story and the documentation and so on was there, and it's such a compelling story and so important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we're very glad that you did write it. So, I want to thank everybody for listening to this podcast today, but I especially want to thank Robert Gelatley for being on the show again. Thanks, Robert.
Okay, thank you very much, Marshall. Very much.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.